From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak. This morning I speak with journalist Maren McKenna. She unpacks the rise of peanut allergies and the groundbreaking new treatments that may change how we prevent and even cure them. Then Allison Page, the local founder of Trail Talk here in Park City. She'll share how walking and talking in nature helps us process emotions and reduces stress, and it helps us reconnect with ourselves. That all coming up this hour on The Mountain Life. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Mountain Life. I'm Lynn Ware Peak. Peanut allergies are on the rise. Emergency visits for life-threatening reactions more than tripled in just a decade. Why? No one knows for sure, but new treatments are offering hope and even the possibility of a cure. In fact, medicine's entire understanding of how to keep children safe from ever-developing allergies is being rethought. My guest today is journalist Maren McKenna. She's been reporting on this breakthrough for Scientific American. It's all in her new article, Can Peanut Allergies Be Cured? Maren McKenna, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thank you so much for having me.
I think that we are just fascinated and confounded entirely by this notion of more and more food allergies, and especially those extraordinary ones that are so life-threatening, like a peanut allergy, and especially for children. You say that it's sort of a mystery to researchers. What's your take after having really researched this so thoroughly?
Such a complex problem. And, you know, I spent many months reporting the story, which is the cover of the print edition of Scientific American in this month. I talked to a lot of researchers, and a lot of people have opinions about why this allergy exists at all and is increasing. The research doesn't actually tell us that. It doesn't tell us exactly why. There's a lot of hypotheses. It might be that, I think everyone's heard at this point of ultra-processed food, so it may be that proteins from peanuts or proteins like ones in peanuts are sneaking into more food. It may be this concept called the hygiene hypothesis, which is that our very early lives now are very, very clean. Think of all the germ-free hand sanitizers and soaps and toys and so forth that we have, and that disrupts our immune systems. But whatever the underlying reason for food allergies and peanut allergy in particular rising, the evidence is that it is rising, that since about the 1990s, the increase in prevalence of peanut allergy and food allergies more broadly is just undeniable. And everyone's, I think, gone onto an airplane and heard a flight attendant say, if you brought any snacks on board, please do not eat them because we have an allergic person on the plane. Everyone who's had a child knows that there's a peanut-free table in the lunchroom. It's everywhere.
Yeah, it really is. I remember my son, who's now 30, when he was in, kindergarten, there was one student in his class that had a severe peanut allergy. And I remember that child's mother coming to the PTA meeting and literally sobbing about this and the absolute danger. So, you know, the whole allergy notion is that our immune systems create, it's an inflammation. That's why airways are sometimes blocked off and we go into what's called anaphylactic shock. Is the notion that we just are having overactive immune systems?
To that particular protein. So the proteins in whatever foods we're allergic to, our immune systems trigger a response that's out of scale to what we've been exposed to. And that's what causes the inflammation that you just mentioned, causes drops in blood pressure, which can potentially be fatal, causes closing of airways. And it's kind of a mystery why that is. But what's going on is the immune system is recognizing something that it has already decided is unsafe for us for some mysterious reason, and reacting overwhelmingly to try to protect us, and in the end, putting us more at risk.
Absolutely. You know, it's funny, until I read your article, it didn't dawn on me about this protein thing, but 90% of food allergies, as you say, are peanuts, kind of number one, milk, eggs, tree nuts, wheat, soybeans, crustaceans, fish, and those all have that protein, I guess, which is really interesting. So, you know, what we, if we're looking holistically at that, our health, right, we try to get to the cause of things instead of treating the symptoms. Oftentimes modern medicine just wants to treat the symptoms. And that's, you know, when we start to pair in other more holistic views of things, getting to the source. But when you can't figure out why there is this source, then you have to go to treating the symptoms. Is that what some of these new remedies and treatments that you highlight in your article are looking at, or are they getting to the source, the cause?
Well, they're working on getting to the cause. Anybody who's listening to this, who's had a child who's allergic to some food, you know, and as you mentioned, peanuts, the one that we sort of are most aware of in society, but food allergy is actually very common in the United States. More than 30 million Americans have some form of food allergy, which means that in an average size classroom, probably two kids have a food allergy. You know, as you said, shellfish, milk, tree nuts, eggs, finfish, all of those trigger allergies. And for the people who have the most severe form, the kind that's really life-threatening, those reactions, there really hasn't been any solution for them except strict avoidance. And for people who are extraordinarily allergic, that is really hard, because we're not talking here about a child accidentally taking a bite of a PBJ, right? Or picking up their friend's peanut butter and jelly. It's that there might be a crumb, a molecule of a dangerous food in what's thought to be a clean food because of manufacturing error or cross-contamination. So because ever since this became a problem, there haven't been good preventive treatments, avoidance has been the only issue. What's new now is that scientists are beginning to tackle that maybe there are ways to not just rely on strict avoidance, to train the immune system into some degree of familiarity with these dangerous proteins, such that people who are highly allergic can be made a little more safe. They might not decide to spend the rest of their life eating PBJs, but they might be safe from, scientists call it bite safe. They might be safe from an accidental exposure. And the way that's working in one of the set of trials that I talk about in the story is that they do very, very careful exposures of the child to the protein in peanuts over a long period of time, very precisely metered doses. And when they get to a certain point, they can actually start eating peanuts or tree nuts or whatever their allergy is as a kind of preventive dose. They graduate to having, let's say, you know, six Reese's Pieces and half a cashew every morning. And that keeps them safe enough that they can begin to live a little more carefree life.
So interesting. You begin the article with a young girl named Annabelle, who's 13 years old, but she goes through one of these clinical trials. And that is the reality for her, is that it goes from a severe peanut allergy to something that is manageable. What is the treatment that she uses? Because you talk about a couple of different types of treatments in the article.
So Annabelle Terry is one of a number of kids who were part of a very large, like, across the country, very complicated with multiple stages trial that asked, can we train these children's immune systems to more safely encounter the protein in peanuts and other foods that's allergenic, if we give them a little bit of help with background administration of an existing pharmaceutical. And the pharmaceutical that they chose is an already well-known drug that most people will recognize under the name Xolair. It starts with an X, X-O-L-A-I-R. There are a lot of ads for it on the internet and on television and so forth. And what Xolair is approved for by the FDA is for severe asthma, breathing difficulty that's linked to allergies. And the way that that works is that it interferes with the biologic cascade that triggers that overreaction and inflammation. So they started to think, and this is more than 10 years ago now, what if we applied that same process of interrupting this immune cascade and at the same time introduced the problematic proteins in very, very tiny, safe, metered doses? Could we train the body to damp down that overreaction? And the answer seems to be yes. And Annabelle was one of the members of this trial. She's 13 now, but she did it when she was younger. And it got her to a place where now she can take as a maintenance dose every day a couple of nuts of different kinds. And that keeps her safe from an overwhelming reaction. Now, that in itself is not perfect because she's eating nuts, which means that she can't be around other nut allergic children when she does that. So it's very difficult, for instance, when she goes to school or goes to camp or something like that, because she has to take a bag of nuts with her. But it has made her what they would consider bite safe, so that now she is protected from any accidental exposure because she's making deliberate exposures. This hasn't worked as well for everyone in this trial. Again, it was a very, very large trial, because sometimes it's hard to get kids to eat the same thing every day, or hard to get them to eat something that they already feel aversive toward because it gave them bad reactions, or that makes their parents very nervous for the same reason. So there's a lot of sort of behavioral and psychological aspects to this, but the science is really solid.
Yeah, this is so interesting. I mean, isn't that whole notion of exposure therapy really what vaccines are? It's a little bit of exposing it to you to activate your immune system in a small way, not an overactive way, to fight off whatever is being introduced.
And it's so interesting that you say that, because people who have other kinds of allergies, like pollen allergies, for instance, to grass or trees or something like that, or maybe to animals, they take shots, right? I think people are quite familiar with the concept of allergy shots.
Right.
Particularly, I live in Atlanta, and Atlanta in the spring is coated in tree pollen. You can sweep it up with a dustpan and a brush. So everyone talks about going to get their allergy shots in about the beginning of March. But allergy shots have never worked for peanut. They were tried several decades ago, and it was just a terrible failure. So the question has always been, how can you safely do this introduction of a tiny amount while keeping the person safe? And this Xolair trial turned out to be one of those ways. Now, there's a really interesting underlying question going on, which is, would exposure itself solve the problem of allergy? And toward the end of the story, I talk about a really fascinating set of studies done primarily in England about whether, if we introduce the proteins in peanuts to babies when they are just at the point where they're starting to consume solids, starting to be weaned, could we short circuit this whole development, this training of the immune system to overreact? This is what was called the LEAP trial. And it began with an observation by an immunologist in Britain who'd gone to give a scientific talk in Israel, that everyone knew about food allergies in kids in Britain, but when he asked his audience about the same allergies in Israel, all of the immunologists he was speaking to looked a little puzzled. They had very little experience with this. It turned out that in Israel, there's a snack. It's kind of like a Cheeto, but it's coated in peanut butter instead of cheese. It's called Bomba. And Trader Joe's actually sells a version of these in their snack aisle. And kids in Israel apparently get fed these very, very early, like within their first 6 months of life. So from the point where their immune system is beginning to develop its defenses against the outside world, they're getting small enough doses of peanut to tell their bodies that peanuts are safe. And a whole bunch of studies spun out over this realization. And it now seems quite solid that if we could get peanut into babies very, very early, it might really change their chances of developing allergy, particularly if they come from families where allergy is already prevalent. But doing that requires changing a lot of other sort of behavioral and social things, like how early do we cease breastfeeding or exclusively breastfeeding, or how early do you introduce solids? It's really sort of a question of how do you implement the finding rather than getting to the finding itself.
So interesting. If you're just joining me on The Mountain Life, I'm having a conversation with journalist Maren McKenna. She has written an article in the recent Scientific American about how we are developing new treatments to cure peanut allergies. So as you've been talking, I've been thinking about that. When I had children, you were supposed to breastfeed as long as you possibly could, and then very slowly introduce, you know, the rice cereals and really put off anything else for as long as you could. I think the idea was to avoid allergies, but now it's the scientific method, right? And we're learning that no, as you say, introducing them, but it's risky. You know, if you introduce them to a peanut at 8 months old, it's probably got to be a little tiny amount. And when you talked about the Bombas, is that what it's called? The peanut peanut butter covered. Is that a little amount that kids are getting in Israel?
Well, I don't think that Israeli moms or dads are handing their babies an entire bag, right? I think that what's going on is that they're getting a tiny bit of this Cheeto-like, but softer and wispier, you know, more able to sort of gum on it snack. Possibly even they're just getting exposed to the dust when other people in the family are eating it. But I think it's actually that they're getting it themselves. Mm. So, you know, what's been so challenging about this LEAP trial, which is more than 10 years old now, is again, this question of the science of implementation. If we've been telling moms for decades to breastfeed as long as possible, and if we're so careful about introducing solids at a certain point while still breastfeeding, and the solids start with something like you described, it's very palatable, like rice cereal or something like that, are we accidentally setting them up for allergy by delaying too long the point at which the potentially problematic proteins enter their diets? Gideon Lack, who was the immunologist who conducted all these studies, who gave that speech in Israel where he saw the shocking result among the doctors listening to him, he thinks that for kids who come from allergic families or who already, even as babies, have shown some indication that they might be subject to allergies, like having asthma or eczema, for instance, he thinks that kids ought to be experiencing peanut proteins as early as 3 or 4 months. And Most breastfeeding guidance says solids not until 6 months. Now, their guidelines have been changed, and various medical societies are now saying, yes, you actually should do that. You should try to get solids into your baby's life if they're peanut allergic, or if you think they're going to be peanut allergic, at these very early dates. But that requires that you have to start your baby on some kind of solid a little earlier than that, which is just different than what we've been telling people all along. Mind you, not different now than what the medical societies say, but different than what they used to say.
Yeah. So going back to the clinical trial with Xolair, is the way you described it makes me understand that you're kind of doing this twofold thing. You're introducing through exposure therapy these really allergenic foods like peanuts, But you're also administering a medication that will reduce inflammation. So as we think of, and lots of people know about the EpiPen, lots of people carry an EpiPen in their backpacks because maybe they're allergic to a bee sting or something like that. That, and that's meant to keep your airway open because it reduces inflammation in your airway. Is the twofold thing, it sounds way less risky and way less scary than to just give your little infant a little bit of peanut in their rice cereal.
So I think we can think of all the science that's happening around peanut allergy right now as sort of occurring at different stages of life and trying different things, but all with the same goal of reducing the impact of the allergy and maybe reducing the allergy at all. There's introduction of the potentially problematic proteins very early. There's exposure therapy. And this is not just having kids eat like tiny bits of peanut protein, but also exposing them via a patch on their skin, which is a trial that's being worked on in several locations around the United States. There's giving them the problematic proteins with a drug already on board that will reduce their reactions so that their immune system can kind of learn that exposure in a safer environment. Probably, to my mind, the most exciting thing is that there is a trial going on now that is just getting started, and it's a very small trial, and this science is going to take a long time to evolve. But everything I just described was in kids, right? Because kids are, they're both around peanuts a lot, but also kids still have developing immune systems. So scientists feel like there's a better chance of sort of like rerouting things in a safe direction. But what happens if you're an adult and you've been living with these severe allergies all your life and they're just getting worse and, you know, your life is at risk? Well, there's this incredibly interesting, incredibly small trial uses two drugs. They both happen to come from a single company. They're both what's called monoclonal antibodies. And given in combination, what they seem to do is to both damp down reactions and temporarily stop the production of the cells in the body that cause the reactions. And then when you stop the drug that's stopping the production of those cells and those cells regrow while you're still taking the first drug, they grow back not having learned that overreaction. So this has been reported successfully in just one person so far. And I don't think there's even yet a piece in a medical journal, a peer-reviewed piece about it, but it was reported at an investor conference for the company that makes these drugs, which is called Regeneron. Out of that, a clinical trial has been spun up. They are only going to have maybe 10 people in it. The third person was just enrolled this month, or maybe it was in the end of August, at Emory University here in Atlanta. And they're going to try in these people to do this two-drug combination to bring them to reset their immune systems and bring their reactions back in a way that ought to be sort of what we would think of as normal. If this works and turns out to be safe in these people, because a first small trial is only ever really focused on safety and a little bit on efficacy, then it will get spun up into larger trials and larger trials. This is going to take years. But it could, if it all works, it could provide a way for people who have lived their whole lives with really severe allergy to actually get their immune systems reset.
Wouldn't that be amazing? It's really promising. Do you feel, after having researched, done the research, and I know you've been involved in public health and global health for a long time, does it feel, I mean, obviously it feels promising to you. Do you feel like there's been enough really, you know, these clinical trials have been large. They've ended with lots of peer-reviewed studies. If you were someone who had a severe peanut allergy, what would be your tact right now?
Well, if I myself had a severe peanut allergy, I would be signing up on the waiting list to get into that adult trial, because while it's complicated and it, you know, it depends on taking particular pharmaceuticals, it does seem like it's really making a difference to the lives of the few people who've been in it so far. If I had young children at this point, or was just having babies, which I'm not, and I thought they were at risk for food allergy, I would feel so much more safe now than I think parents have felt over the past 30 years, because it took a little while for science to catch up to the fact that peanut allergy and other allergies were really ramping up in the population. And then it took a little while for science to start figuring out exactly how do we interrogate what's going on and try to fix it. But now those questions have reached maturity. There are trials that are completed. There are FDA approvals for treatments. No one will talk about a cure at this point, but everyone I spoke to in the food allergy research world really seemed to feel like they were making a difference in the lives of kids and families in a substantial manner for the first time.
Even going from having a severe allergy, which could cause death, and you've heard those stories, we all have, and it's tragic, to just having a regular old allergy certainly would be a complete game changer, wouldn't it?
It would. Now, of course, you know, some of the kids who've been through these trials, even though they can take their maintenance dose of a couple of nuts a day, they're still, you know, none of them, again, are going to like live a diet on a diet of peanut butter and jelly. They are still having to be careful. They might still carry an EpiPen. Now, the incredible market expansion of the EpiPen is sort of the background of the story of this. It didn't used to be a multi-billion dollar product. It was introduced for insect stings, and then it became used for food allergy because food allergy needed it so much. So no one is going back to quite normal at this point, but I do feel that kids are growing up in a potentially, well, we can't say potentially safer world because the allergens are still out there, but they themselves are being potentially made more safe because of the understanding that science has gained over the past, you know, 30 years of work.
Yeah. By means of sort of wrapping up here, Maren, you mentioned in the beginning the hygiene hypothesis and the fact that really we should be exposed. You know, the concept of we've interviewed the doctor who wrote the book, Let Them Eat Dirt. And the fact that, you know, we know now through research that kids who, for example, grow up in a house with a dog are healthier because they are exposed to all of these different, you know, microbes and things. And it builds our immune system. It doesn't make it overact. So again, it's that exposure therapy. Hygiene hypothesis, it's the first time I've heard of that, but it's something that we're doing wrong, obviously, because these peanut allergies didn't really arise until, like you say, the early 90s in large quantities.
The hygiene hypothesis is just such a fascinating concept to me. And this idea and that phrase has been around for, I don't know, 30, 40 years at this point. And it arose from some observations in Europe that, as you say, kids, younger kids in families had less excitable immune systems than their older siblings, because their older siblings were going to school or daycare and then bringing infections home, like colds and so forth. Similarly, kids who grew up on farms had less excitable immune systems than ones who grew up in cities, kids who had a pet in the house and so forth. And this hypothesis has been through a couple of, I guess you could say, generations intellectually. And where I think people have landed with it at this point is that it's not the farm itself. It's not the dog or cat itself. It's that at a critical moment, early in its development, our immune systems get exposed in a safe manner to microbes that we have lived with throughout our evolution as human beings. Mm-hmm. And that exposure teaches our immune systems not to overreact to anything in the world, right? To just be more chill about living in the world. And it's when we have the ultra clean, ultra modern lives that we all have, where, you know, every single thing that we buy for our kitchen says kills 99.9% of germs. And we put germicidal chemicals into toothpaste and toys and car dashboards and things like that. And we give kids antibiotics very, very early. All of those things affect the way that our immune systems interact with the world in a way that doesn't serve us well. Now, I am not saying that we should like stuff dirt in our kids' mouths, nor am I saying that we should not take antibiotics when we really need them. But I do think we're coming around to the realization that a little bit of mess, right? A little bit of letting kids get dirty, a little bit of waiting to make sure whether an ear infection really needs antibiotics or is going to resolve on its own. You know, letting them roll on, around on the rug with the door, using vinegar and water instead of 99.9% germ killing chemicals. All of those things help our immune systems to remember what they were for. And we've kind of trained them out of that.
Well, anecdotally, one of the very few photos that I remember of myself from being a baby is I'm outside playing and I've got mud and dirt coming out of my mouth and dripping down my chin. And as it turns out, I'm not allergic to anything and I'm actually quite addicted to peanut butter. So there's your anecdotal evidence.
Worked for you.
Yeah. I guess so. Maren McKenna, thank you so much for joining me on The Mountain Life. This is fascinating. If you want to read Maren's article, it's called Can Peanut Allergies Be Cured?
It's the cover of the print version of the September edition of Scientific American, and it's available online now.
Wonderful article and wonderful work you do. Your job must be really fun.
It's fascinating every day. Sometimes scary. Back when I covered emerging diseases more, I used to be known as Scary Disease Girl, but it's never not fascinating.
Maren, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life. I'm Lynn Ware Peak. My next guest is Allison Page. She's the founder of Trail Talk here in Summit County. Allison is a psychiatric nurse practitioner and mental health therapist who spent over 15 years walking and talking with clients. Back in 2009, she founded Trail Talk with a simple belief that movement and nature are some of the most powerful tools we have to process emotions, reduce stress, and reconnect with ourselves. Allison joins me now to share the insights she's gained on the trail, emotional tune-ups for real life. Allison Page, welcome to The Mountain Life. Welcome back to The Mountain Life.
Thank you, Lynn. It's been a long time, and I really appreciate you having me on.
It has been a long time, but I've known that you're out there because I hear about you out there still doing Trail Talk 15 years later. I think in those 15 years, research and science has confirmed something that you have known for a very long time, and that is nature is a panacea. It heals.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. When I first started, I was telling someone recently that I was back in grad school for the second time. When my kids were in high school, I decided I had to take some time out of the workforce because my daughter was ill. And so when I went back, I'm like, what do I really want to do? And I was like, I want to be a therapist. But I was already a nurse practitioner, and I have been since 85. So I've been out there a long time working as a nurse. And so I went back to grad school, and while I was in grad school, I was more stressed out than I'd been forever. And during grad school, they're talking about self-care and teaching our clients self-care. And I was out walking with my dog in the woods. It was a snowy day, and I lived up in Pine Brook, and it was way up on the hill. And I just was like, oh my God, this is my therapy. And then it was like, ding, 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 I'm gonna do this. And so I'm like, I'm gonna walk and talk with my clients. And then I ran home and looked it up. And I found a guy in New York. He was kind of the first man that kind of brought walk and talk into mainstream private practice. And he was walking around Central Park, and we talked for a long time, and I said, well, I'm going to do it in Utah. And so I trademarked Trail Talk and haven't looked back since. Yeah.
Oh, it's great. I bet he was envious. He's, oh, you're going to do it in Utah? Oh,
yeah. Man. Yeah. But he was a hoot. And I really learned a lot from it. I kept in touch with him over the years. And so anyway, it's been a great career for me. So yeah, walking and talking with clients, I actually what I did is I tried to align myself with the wilderness therapy community. I didn't grow up, I say, in psychiatry. I was a pediatric nurse practitioner before I became a psychiatric nurse practitioner. And so I was very, very connected with the pediatric community, but not the psych community. And so I go into the wilderness therapy group and started going to some of their conferences. And I had no place at the table because I was a nurse, not a therapist. And it was like I was in a different camp, you know? And so it was really hard for me to penetrate that group. But what I decided to do is I'm going to take wilderness therapy treatment modalities and I'm going to bring them into mainstream private practice. Why should all the wayward kids have all the fun? Their parents really need a way to process things, and nature can be my therapeutic milieu. That's my office. And again, walk and talk therapy is not a competitive sport. People say, why don't you go skiing with people? Why don't you go on hikes and stuff? It's like, well, my model is really about side by side. We're on equal footing, where I'm not having anybody follow me up a trail. We're actually side by side and in a place where it's safe for me, them. And as you're walking, it's bilateral movement. So that's the beauty of walking, is the bilateral. And that's, I'm an EMDR trained therapist too. And that's a trauma focused therapy, but back and forth, left brain, right brain, what that does. And you've known this because you do it. You go out with your friends, your husband, your peers, and you have something that's bothering you emotionally. Maybe you're feeling tense, but then when you get back, you're like, I got to figure it out. Because what happens with that walking and talking is that it decreases the emotional valence or intensity of an issue. And then you're able to put your thinking cap on and you can think and feel at the same time. I mean, that's our goal in life, yeah. You know, to be able to think and feel, because I can feel a strong emotion, but I can be like Chicken Little, this guy is falling. But if I can say, slow it down, let's take some breaths. That's where mindfulness comes in, is really trying to self-regulate so that you can think clearly. And that's what moving the side by side. And so that's why nature and walking, it's just a no-brainer.
Yeah. So what is your client makeup? Obviously they live here in Summit County. Sometimes I understand you do, how do you call it, remote side-by-side trail talk?
Yeah.
But what's the age range of your clients?
I'm a pediatric nurse practitioner also. So when I went into psychiatry, I really wanted to experience adults. And again, I'm a prescriber and I'm not real keen on that. I mean, I'm a very conservative prescriber because being in pediatrics, everything's very conservative. There has to be a bacterial focus, but because you don't just give people meds, right? Or kids meds. But in psychiatry, when I was training, it was like, I got to figure out what it's like to work with adults, because I'm just such a peds focused person. I love play therapy and stuff. But I started working with adults and realized that these are consenting adults who want to do therapy. And so what I decided to do as I grew my practice was I would only see children and teens if they wanted to see me. I was not going to be fix them. You know, parents will do that. They'll say, you got to fix him. You know what I mean? It's like that. It doesn't work like that, because we live in a family system. So I'm very family systems oriented. So if a parent brings a teenager in and the teen says, yeah, I really want to do therapy. If I'm working with that child and I realize that, ooh, this child does adult relationships just fine. They don't need a relationship with me. They need attunement with daddy or mom. Then I know I'm going to get fired, because I'll ask the parent to come in and say, I really want to do a different type of therapy. And that is having you in therapy with your son so we can work on attunement. And if the parent agrees, it's powerful, because that's the problem. It's right. Really it's a family systems issue. Kids and teens, if they say, absolutely, I'm into it. I'm not going to sit in a office or walk and be treated with a silent treatment because they're trying to punish their mommy. You know what I mean? Yeah. But the people that are gravitating toward me, many are young married men. And the reason why is they have anxiety, or any age male that says, I would really like to talk to someone, but sitting in an office staring at a stranger, it's really uncomfortable. So I find that men will say, I'll meet you outside, you know, and that affords for intermittent eye contact too.
Right. Well, that was my point that I was thinking about earlier is I have a friend who talks about the time on a chairlift with her child, and they're looking straight ahead. So you don't have to look at each other, and you're outside. And we know, you know, I know from being on the trail with my friends, looking where I'm going to take my next step. We all open up so much more because you're not, I mean, what is it? We love eye contact on the one hand, but on the other hand, it's nice to be able to say your deepest, innermost, scariest feelings out loud without having to look at anyone.
You can absolutely. Yeah. And think about someone that's on the, used to be called Asperger's, but now it's autism spectrum. Mm-hmm. You know, eye contact can be very uncomfortable. That allows people, and then just being with a stranger. Can she read my mind? What if I'm thinking something, you know? I tease people and say, I forgot to tell you I'm clairvoyant. So be careful with what you think, you know. I use humor. I happen to like humor a lot. And so that's a big part of my practice too, is really helping people understand how to find joy and what are ways that you can find joy. And laughter is a really, I give people assignments to say, okay, this week you have to belly laugh every single day. Really? I never belly laugh. It's like, well, we're going to start practicing that, because bringing joy into your life is really finding humor.
I wanted to mention also about the not having to look at someone. Many people cry in therapy. It's release. And no one loves how they look when they're crying.
Yeah, correct.
The therapist isn't looking at me. I can just make the ugliest crying face and it's all good. And you can just let it out.
Yeah, no, that's true. So that intermittent eye contact is a really important part of walk and talk therapy. It also makes them feel that it's less clinical. I tell people, it's like, you know, you're not mentally ill. What happens is we fall in that word ill, I find that has a lot of negative connotations and stigma to it. I tell people, look, we fall in and out of mental wellness. That's just like getting a virus, you know. I may not be dying of terminal cancer, but I might need some treatment if the virus goes on for more than 10 days, you know. So think of it like that. You need an emotional tune-up because you've gone through a crisis, a life event. So when you're walking and talking, you just feel less clinical. You have the opportunity to just, it gives you more space. Other people say, I just don't think it works. And I'm like, well, it's been working for me for 15 years. And I definitely have a unique style, and I can look at people from a biological perspective and a nature nurture, because of being a nurse, I'm actually thinking of them from a genetic perspective and what's happening with them physically. And that gives them a lot of insight, because I may say, you know, we got to get some labs, and I think you need to go see your primary care doctor, because it could be a vitamin D deficiency. It could be B12, but let's make sure we're not missing any underlying medical issues that could be leading to anxiety and depression. And I like that. I like a team approach. I know all the pharmacists in town. I know many of the doctors, and we check each other's best thinking too. I really like the pharmacists that when I prescribe, they'll ask me, okay, why this dosage or whatever. So it's nice to have a community of people that's small enough that we can be part of a wellness support team.
So you mentioned before that you don't do trail talk on trails that you can't go side by side. So does that rule out all of the single track, or are there trails that, you know, you can kind of, some of the wider single tracks you can walk side by side on?
Oh yeah. And it depends on the client. So you got to remember, I've been some of these clients I've been seeing for 15 years. And what's really great is I say to people, I said, you know, I talk about termination too. It's like, sometimes you just need to take a break and maybe you want a second opinion, but let's terminate and say, I'm going to take a break. And I'm like, great, come back when you're ready for another emotional tune-up. And someone might disappear for a year. I just had someone come back after 5-6 years. They came back to town and they're like, I need a tune-up. But I know I can measure depending on how fast people walk. I know exactly how to do an hour-long walk or 2 hour. I know where we can find privacy. I can do I do couples therapy on the trail. So I've gotten really creative, which is so fun. I like that part of it.
Have you ever, 15 years ago, we didn't have the pedometers like we have now, yeah. But I'm curious if you have any idea how many hundreds of miles you have walked doing Trail Talk.
Well, during COVID, I'm not kidding you, I was walking 8 hours a day just because people wanted to see people in person. And yeah. So I was seeing, and there was a crisis and people wanted to see me. So I was really busy. So, but how many, I don't know, a lot, but the funniest thing, Lynn, I went to a vascular surgeon last winter because I had some trouble with a lower leg. I was having some pain in one of my large veins, and I'm laying there on the table with this, you know, here I am, this young girl's putting a Doppler on my calves, and she's like, oh my gosh, you have the best perfusion in your calves. And she said, you must walk a lot. And I'm like, yeah, I do walk a lot. And I thought, score. Yeah. I've got great perfusion in my calves from all this walking. It's been a great health benefit for me as well.
You didn't say, yeah, I walk for a living. Well, we know that there are certain things that can release emotion. One of those is breath work. I suspect that your goal is not to get up the heart rate so high that you're doing this, you're needing to do deep breath work, or that you're getting this little endorphin buzz or whatever you want to, however you refer to that. And yet you're breathing fresh air, it's crisp or it's hot, whatever. How are you getting your clients, your patients, to release more as a result of actually walking? You talked a little bit about the
bilateral movement.
Bilateral movement. But yeah. What else?
Well, I stop a lot, and I know where all the benches are. I do mindfulness practice down on the trail between Copper Moose and the White Barn. So through there, there's several places I can sit where we have the stream running by us.
That's beautiful.
And so I can sit and do mindfulness exercises there. So oftentimes when we're walking, we'll pull over and sit and I'll teach them mindfulness. I'll teach them breathing and understanding that concept. So I do a lot of, it's called mindfulness CBT. So the thing about trauma-focused therapy is it's really a combination of a lot of different therapeutic treatment modalities like CBT, DBT, breath work, mindfulness. Depending on what the client's needs are, I can kind of read like they really need to get some stuff off their chest. They're not ready to do something. Or if I see that they're really having a hard time self-regulating, it's like, let's take a break. Let's sit down. But I kind of know in advance what I'm going to need to do with a client based on the work we've been doing. But actually what I do now is like, I get bored. I got ADHD too, like the rest of us, you know? And it's like, oh, I think I want to be out East Canyon. I love it out there. And depending on the time of day, East Canyon is awesome to see wildlife, to be near running water, to do mindfulness, to walk. And then sometimes I'm like, oh, I think you want to bring your dog. Why don't we go to run amok? Or if you want to go over to Willow Creek, you know, so again, mm-hmm. I know where I can do the best work with the client I'm with.
Yeah. I've been thinking about, and we know this town is becoming more populated, and ever since COVID, you know, so many more people are out on the trails that we know and love. How do you handle that? You know, when people are walking by, you always see people you know on the trails and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. How do you handle that?
How I manage that? Well, I have pretty detailed HIPAA service agreements and kind of outline kind of how my therapy works. But when I meet them, I ask them first, have you ever done therapy before? And I love having people that have never done therapy before, because it's just, it's refreshing to introduce them to a less intense style, you know, because I don't have a pen writing things down. And so I tell people right away, what do you know about therapy? Let's talk about what happens when we're walking and talking, because it is a different. I said, I've been in town for a long time. I know a lot of people. Do you like dogs? Every single dog will come up to us. We can touch them. We can do whatever. But as we're walking and talking, someone might say, hey, Allison, I'm going to call you. And I'll say, hello. And I just know that might happen. And if we run into someone, you know, you can say hello, but I can just be a non-event. You know, I can be someone that's just walking with you, whatever. And then we can pick a neighborhood maybe where you're not going to see people. Like someone will say, I don't want to be in Park Meadows because that's where I live. Okay, so I do that. Others mm-hmm. could care less. They're like, they see me at a concert. They're like, oh my God, everybody come meet my therapist. You know, I say, when we're walking by people, just know that most people are worried about themselves. But we go by certain places, we can lower our voices, be respectful of our surroundings, you know? And I said, let's just see what happens.
So we were talking before we went on air about how insurance coverage for mental health has changed since COVID and changed in a positive way. Can you go into that a little bit?
So during COVID, because I had been preaching mental health parity since the beginning of time, I really felt an ethical requirement to take insurance. So when I first started, it's like, I can only do self-pay because insurance companies are horrible to work with. They don't pay you anything and you're chasing after your money. But during COVID, it's like, nope, I'm going to do it. I tell you, it almost made me leave the practice because I every weekend I was trying to collect money. And it was like, I'm going broke. I can't sustain this model. So yeah. Right now, but what was happening was the insurance companies were realizing that we got to offer our clients mental health therapy. So, I mean, there are some clients I had that had, you know, call center jobs and they had great health insurance, which was awesome for the first time. I don't know if that's still the case everywhere. You know, each insurance company is different what they'll offer, you know, maybe 20 visits in a year, or a lot of people have really high deductibles. And so their mental health services don't kick in until they meet their deductible. Yeah.
In the past, you've had multiple therapists working with you, but you're solo now. You know, what does the future look like for Trail Talk?
Well, I don't see myself retiring real soon. I love what I do. I plan on living here for a while, but I am licensed now in Idaho because my son lives in the Sun Valley, Wood River Valley. So when I go up there, I can see clients in that community. But when I'm traveling, I can see my Park City clients or Utah clients, because I am licensed in Utah. But I'm currently licensed in Idaho, and I'm about a couple of days maybe from being licensed in California. That's been a hard one because my daughter lives in California. As my children grow families, my plan is to be able to spend more time with them so I can go between the three states.
Oh, that sounds like a perfect setup.
Yeah. And the thing with mental health therapy is I can age into it. And I'm aging into it well because I have well-perfused calves. We know that. but also the funniest thing is I have this domain name and it's Rock and Talk Therapy. And I've maintained this. I pay for this domain name because I think it's hysterical. Because I know that when I end up in a rocking chair, I can do rock and talk therapy. I'm going to change Trail Talk to Rock and Talk. Isn't that brilliant? So I could be, maybe I will be 90 years old, still doing therapy.
Well, we are out of time, Allison. I feel like I could talk to you all day, but maybe I ought to just walk on the trails with you and we'll keep talking. How's that?
Yeah, so you never know. I might see you on the trails.
That's right. Well, Allison Page is my guest. She's the founder of Trail Talk. That title is what it is, Trail Talk. Oh, what's your tagline?
Better emotional health starts with one step.
There you go.
It was a pleasure seeing you again. And I really thank you for asking me back after 15 years. It's amazing how fast time goes, huh?
Really does. All right, Allison, thank you so much.
Thank you, Lynn. I appreciate that.
And thanks for tuning in to The Mountain Live here on KPCW Park City. You can access our archive shows at kpcw.org under the Shows tab and The Mountain Life, or wherever you get your podcasts, KPCW The Mountain Life.